This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. A lot of us miss Jon Stewart and are left with a little hole in our lives. But let's focus on something positive. In case you haven't noticed, Larry Wilmore's satirical news show, The Nightly Show, has become a great place to go for a comedic take on the day's news, and occasionally for some genuine outrage. Last January, he took over Comedy Central's 11:30 spot, which had belonged to Stephen Colbert. Wilmore was a guest on Fresh Air a few weeks after his show premiered, but The Nightly Show has continued to evolve, so we asked Wilmore to come back and talk about finding his voice. When he started his show, he was already familiar to many Daily Show viewers from his role as its senior black correspondent. The Nightly Show has assembled a diverse group of correspondents, writers, and panelists, and the show is especially good at addressing issues dealing with race. Terry spoke with Larry Wilmore last Wednesday and began with this recent clip from The Nightly Show.
I just have to say, this past Sunday marked 1 year since the shooting death of Michael Brown and subsequent uprising in Ferguson that followed him. Man, I can't believe it. It's been a year already. Whew! I mean, it's crazy how time flies when you're in a constant panic about getting shot by the cops.
Larry Wilmore, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on what you've been doing on your show. You joked on the first edition of your show that all the good, bad race stuff had already happened, and there was, like, nothing left to say. Like, you're done.
Yep.
And since then, I'll just rattle off a list here. Walter Scott was killed by a cop in Charleston, South Carolina. Freddie Gray died in a police van. A cop pulled his gun on a black teenage girl and then sat on her as she was returning from a pool party in Texas. Dylann Roof killed 9 people at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. The Confederate flag was removed from the State House in Charleston, South Carolina. Sandra Bland was stopped after failing to signal when she was changing lanes. She died in jail, probably a suicide. A University of Cincinnati campus policeman killed Samuel DuBose. I know you knew that there was going to be racial stuff happening, but really, did you expect all this to be happening early on in your tenure on the show?
That is the saddest introduction to a comedy segment I think I have ever heard. Oh, my God. Larry, let's just remind the audience you're doing a comedy show. Oh, my God. That's just a typical American year, sounds like to me.
This is the stuff you have to deal with on your comedy show. And
exactly.
Somehow find what's funny about it so that you can...
There's not a lot. There's really not a lot.
After the shooting at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Nine people were killed there, a massacre, really horrible. And then it's up to you to find something to say about it. I want to play how you handled it.
Sure.
So here's Larry Wilmore on The Nightly Show.
Now, I have to tell you guys, we weren't going to talk much about this at all. I mean, seriously, we're a comedy show, right? I mean, what we built here isn't really designed to handle this kind of tragedy. And let me just say, I know we talk about race a lot on the show, but I think we can all agree this time that this is a racially motivated attack. Yeah. You know, I think it's, but also, it couldn't be clearer when it comes out of the killer's mouth, right? But even with all of that evidence, and on a day like today, Fox News just makes my head explode.
Well, last night's deadly attack taking place at a historic church in South Carolina. The gunman's horrifying attack on faith.
The question is, was it a crime out of race or religion?
They could be calling it a hate crime because it happened in a religious institution.
So if we're not safe in our own churches, then where are we safe?
And although it's being investigated as a hate crime, there's still some pieces we have to put together.
Some look at it as, well, it's because it was a white guy, apparently, and a black church. But you made a great point just a moment ago about the hostility toward Christians. So, and it was a church.
Okay. All right. I know you guys don't want to admit that racial stuff isn't going on. But how can there be any doubt when it came out of the gunman's mouth? Let me remind you what he said.
I want to shoot black people.
He told his victims, I want to shoot black people. I think when he says black people, he means black people and not Christians.
There's Larry Wilmore on The Nightly Show. Can you describe what went on in the writer's room that day, figuring out what to do about the Charleston massacre?
That was a very difficult day. I remember Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, they decided not to do anything at all. It was such a difficult day. I don't think they did any produced comedy in his first act. And we were really wondering about it. And I think I was just so outraged by the coverage of it as a faith incident, because I take those things seriously. If someone is attacking someone because of faith, that is a serious issue. But this was clearly because of race.
Did Fox News make it easier for you to find where the joke was? Because they became the joke in a way.
Yes. In that sense, absolutely. And part of you kind of feels a little guilty for even having laughs on that day. But then the other part of you feels like sometimes you need to laugh and to get out something, you know, just to express some kind of emotion, just to be able to deal with those types of tragedies. You know, and there are tragedies that happen all the time in America, but there are certain types of tragedies that kind of pull us together and make us pause and give us a chance to reflect about where we are, where we're going, and that sort of thing. And it's incidents like this that I think give us that type of opportunity. So, you know, getting laughs out of it, we're a comedy show, that's kind of our job, unfortunately. It is the biggest irony of ironies I think I've ever faced in my entire career, Terry, I'll be honest with you, that I would be mining this type of territory on a daily basis and getting laughs out of it.
Well, you know, like on The Daily Show, you were the, quote, black correspondent, and you were supposed
senior
to...
Senior black correspondent.
Excuse me, I didn't mean
it's
to
important
demean
that you
your
use
role.
The proper terminology.
That's right. And you were supposed to, like, satirically represent the black people on the show. But what's, like, the sense of responsibility you feel now as, you know, as an African-American mm-hmm. hosting a satirical news show every night in this era where there's a lot of, you know, racially motivated attacks going on?
Well, it's interesting. On The Daily Show, you know, you were very happy to be on this show with Jon Stewart, who had this incredible view of the world, and the comedy went through the prism of Jon's brain, you know, and you were happy to be a part of that. What's different about this show is I get to control the narrative myself. You know, I don't have to do it through someone else's vision, as great as that vision is. And what I try to do in this show, I have to broaden it out somewhat. Race is very important, of course, but so is class and so is gender. You know, I've always said from the beginning, our show, we try to take on the point of view of the underdog, and we look for the underdog stories and who's being underrepresented, no matter where that story may be. We did a very touching thing on the show. There was this kid. He was supposed to be a valedictorian, and he was going to use his valedictory speech to come out of the closet and to share with his parents at the graduation that he was gay. So it was going to be this very personal moment. And the principal wouldn't allow him to do that. And in not allowing him to do that, he actually called his parents and outed the kid to his parents on the phone. I could not believe it, Taylor. Yeah. We were aghast at the show that a principal would do that. And this was such an important moment for the kid, and they wouldn't allow him to make that speech. So we reported this on the show, you know. And then as a surprise to the audience, we brought the kid out and had him do his speech on our show. We were all laughing and crying at the same time. And he was so funny, too. It was a very funny speech, you know. And it was such a moving moment, and it just reminded us all, you know, the underdog stories we really are passionate and we really care about. And it just so happens that for me, I get to own the racial part of that story because of who I am. It gets to be our particular corner that we can own in the same way that Jon owned the political corner. You know, when Jon talked about the war, talked about the hanging chads, you know, he had that authority to talk about it. It was what he was very passionate about.
Are there things that you feel you can say as an African-American satirist that, like, a white person couldn't?
You mean starting with the N-word?
sure.
I think, of course. But whatever your thing is, you get to own your thing. And that's cool. I think everybody knows that rule. And blacks, we've kind of had that relationship in a lot of different ways where we could talk about our role in America, you know, for instance, in a way that some people can't. So I think whatever your thing is, I think everybody accepts that you get to own your thing. It gets a little dangerous when someone else tries to own it, I think.
So I want to give another example of how you've been dealing with issues in the news. So this was after Sandra Bland was pulled over for a minor traffic violation, and a police dash cam recorded what happened. You played the video and showed how the police officer keeps escalating things, like she's in a bad mood and isn't being like, totally compliant about it. But but he keeps escalating things in ways you keep pointing out until he finally like demands that she put out her cigarette, that she gets out of the car. He threatens to remove her from the car. And I should mention in this clip that we're going to hear, we're also going to hear a clip within the clip of Don Lemon on CNN.
I saw a woman who was very irritated, probably having a bad day, most likely because she was pulled over, right? Smoking a cigarette to calm down, complied with everything the officer asked for. Then it got confusing because he told her to put out her cigarette, but then offered to light her up by pointing a taser at her head. Now, to me and most reasonable people, it's very clear that this officer was wrong.
If you are being stopped by a police officer, whether that police officer is right or wrong, don't you do what he says until afterwards, then you can sue him. Then you're still alive.
Okay, first of all, I don't know who you're yelling at. And secondly, should one be on one's best behavior when the cop pulls one over? Ideally, yes. But most importantly, the cop is a professional. Right? I mean, should he not have been on such a power trip? Okay, now I'm yelling, Don Lemon, thanks. Sorry, let me calm down for a second. I mean, it's easy to say, black people, why aren't you acting like the Dowager Countess when a cop pulls you over? Right? Oh, hello, officer, I'm so pleased you unexpectedly dropped in on me. Oh. Would you like some tea? I brewed in my glove compartment here. Right next to my stash of weed you're suspecting that I have. God. I mean, yes, that would make sense. But on the other hand, the fact that we live in a world where black people have to strategize so they're not brutalized by police is insane.
Okay, that last line, that's not even a comedy line. That's just like a this is insane line.
Yes.
Can you talk about writing that, and again, like coming up in the writer's room with how you wanted to handle this particular story.
Right. Well, that's our thesis point. That's the line that I'll say, look, here's what I feel is going on here at this moment. I remember when we were tackling that particular part of it, I had just reread Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, the month before. I'd like to reread certain books just to get them back in my head, you know. And I'm a huge fan of Gladwell. I just think he's brilliant, the way he synthesizes information. But in Blink, it's interesting. It's so ironic that it all makes sense again now, where he talks about those moments of escalation that police officers can go through. And he uses the incident, I think, that happened, I think it was in Harlem, I'm not sure, where he carefully plots out, it's fascinating, Terry, of how each second there was a certain type of escalation that didn't necessarily need to happen, you know, and how much of it is the officer's responsibility to be in control of that. And that's what training is for. That's why training is so important in police work, is to make sure your body doesn't take over what you're supposed to do, because your heart starts racing and you just get into this mode. A lot of this I didn't even know about. You know, it's almost like you go into dinosaur brain mode where that just takes over and you just act instinctively. And when you're acting instinctively on this kind of primal level, a lot of things happen. Things like when we talk about systemic bias or those type of things, you act out in certain ways. And it's very worrisome to me. It's something that we don't talk about in police behavior towards certain individuals. And that's what I was thinking about when we were doing that piece, was Gladwell, and how, yeah, this woman had a bit of an attitude. She was a bit upset that day. I don't know what was going on through her, but I feel like it's still, regardless of that, the police officer, it's his responsibility not to escalate that. You acknowledge that, yeah, she's having a bad day. Let's just finish this and let's be done with it. But to escalate it to pointing a taser at her and dragging out of that car was so unnecessary. And also the fact that as a black person in America, when you're pulled over by the police, you have to strategize in a way so you bad things don't happen to you, you know, it's just terrible.
Your show started in January on Martin Luther King Day, And it's changed. I think it's really evolved. I liked it a lot when it started. I like where you're going now. I think you've de-emphasized the panel discussion. It's still there, but it's not. Mm-hmm. I think it's not as long. You've added more interactions with your correspondents, more emphasis mm-hmm. on your opening monologue. Describe a little bit how you've tried to and just like toy with the format of the show sure. as the show was learning, as you were learning what the show's voice was.
Yeah, it's very difficult. You're kind of creating a show in front of the audience, which is a very difficult proposition. On top of that, I'm following the brilliant Stephen Colbert, who was beloved in that time slot. You know, I mean, people are holding your feet to the fire immediately. And so right out of the box, we wanted to establish our show as different, with a different energy, different point of view. For me personally, as the host, oh man, Terry, it was so difficult those first couple months. I mean, you're just in the middle of the storm, just trying to figure out how to do the show, wondering if it's working, if you even feel funny. And as I was doing it, I got a lot of counsel from Jon Stewart, which was great. And Jon was very tough on me, by the way, but tough in a good way, where he's tough with Jon is always tough with the truth. He gives you praise when you get it, you know, when you're there, when you're seeing it, you know. And that's what I love about Jon. His clarity is really amazing. It's frustrating because he always seems to be right, too. It's one of the most frustrating things about working with Jon. It's true. Even when you think, no, Jon, sorry, Jon, you're wrong on this one. About a week later, you go, he's right. How did he do that?
Can you give us an example of something he said that turned out to be really good advice?
Well, absolutely. The biggest thing he said in the beginning, he would almost say it with, not really anger, but maybe frustration. He would say, hey, man, stop being a host. Stop it. Just be yourself out there. Just stop hosting the show.
What does that mean? What did that mean to you?
Well, it took a while for me to interpret it. But what it is, when you're first starting a show like that, you're acting everything because you're not comfortable yet, you know. But you can't fool Jon. He can see right through that. So no matter how much praise I got about the show, Jon's like, no. You're pretending this right now. You're not owning it yet. You got to own it. You got to put your opinion out there, and you got to just get inside there and just be it, you know. And it took a while to understand that because you're so nervous about everything and you're trying to I'm producing the show and starring in it. There's a lot of balls in the air, right? But after a while, I understood what he was talking about. We had these conversations several times, you know, and he would be more emphatic each time. And it was funny because sometimes he would do this. This was hilarious. I would do like what I thought was a really fun show. I thought, man, that was really funny. And so I meet with Jon and he goes, so, man, so how's it going? How did you think last night's show went? And I know that's a trap. I already know it's a trap. Right. I go, I thought it was good. And he's like, oh, you did? I'm like, yes, I did. I thought it was good. And then we'd start this conversation and I'd slowly realize, okay, I get why he's considering it not what I should be doing. For him, it didn't matter that I got laughs or that I got this. He was always encouraging me to raise the bar, not just in content, but in making sure that my point of view was very clear and very precise and that I owned it and that I was myself. So he kept pushing me into that. So that was the evolution of the show, to be honest with you. It all centered around that.
So you were describing how Jon Stewart told you, mm-hmm. you have to develop your voice, you have to have an opinion and own it. I want to play an example of a piece where I think sure. you really did that. So
thank you.
This is about the Confederate flag and the controversy about whether it should have been, you know, this is before it was officially taken down in Charleston, sure. South Carolina, so there was still the controversy about whether it should be taken
right.
down. So here's your take on that. It's kind of like an editorial that you were calling For the Record. So here's Larry Wilmore on The Nightly Show.
Okay, for the record, the Confederate flag is not a proud symbol of tradition or heritage. It's a symbol of oppression and intimidation. That's not my opinion. That's an objective fact. On March 21st, 1861, the Vice President of the Confederacy, Alexander H. Stephens, stated that the Confederate government was based on the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man. That speech is now called the Cornerstone Speech because that idea is the cornerstone of the Confederacy. You don't get clearer than that. Now, some people say that Southern states should fly the Confederate flag because it's a symbol of their heritage. But if we flew every flag from our past, why aren't we flying the Union Jack in front of the White House? right? And for the record, South Carolina, you don't get to make the heritage argument because the Stars and Bars hasn't been flying over the state house since the Civil War. It went up in 1961 to mark the centennial of the Civil War. And coincidentally, right around when the black people started with the wanting of the civil rights. In 1961, it was a reminder to black people that they should know their place. It has always been used as a symbol of intimidation and terror. And that's what it remains today. In fact, because displaying the swastika is illegal across much of Europe, skinheads and neo-Nazis often adopt the Confederate flag in its place. It's such a racist symbol that it does double duty as the backup racist symbol for another racist symbol. That's crazy. Okay. So, for the record, I get it that plenty of honorable people have fuzzy feelings about the Confederate flag, but that's irrelevant. Their nostalgia will never trump the people who see it as a symbol of hate. And for a state to fly this flag, that hate is the message they send to their people. So, for the record, does it really have to be a debate on whether or not you should take it down? Just take it down. You won't get in trouble. Right? Just do it. Do it right now. Go ahead. Seriously. Take it down now.
So it's Larry Wilmore on The Nightly Show. Well, you had a point of view.
That's
clearly
exactly
expressed.
Yes. And that, and by the way, John called me up on those occasions and said, that's what I'm talking about.
Did
man.
He say that that's after this piece?
Yes, absolutely. He said, that's what I'm talking about, you know. And I was like, yes, I understand. I get it, you know. It's just owning it. In the beginning of the show, I was so interested in hearing from other people and corralling a conversation, let's say, you know, what about this voice and that voice and that voice? And so the idea was, well, let's just focus on your voice first, and then we'll let those other voices in. So it was going from very egalitarian to very dictatorial, let's just say.
Larry Wilmore, congratulations on the show so far.
Thank you, Terry.
It's really been great, and thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Larry Wilmore spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Wilmore is the host of The Nightly Show, which airs Monday through Thursday nights at 11:30 on Comedy Central. In the late 1960s, few writers were better known than William F. Buckley Jr. and Gore Vidal. Buckley was the founder and editor of the conservative National Review and had his own television show, Firing Line. Vidal was by then known for his play-turned-movie The Best Man, his historical novel Julian, and his best-selling satire Myra Breckinridge. A new documentary, Best of Enemies, by Robert Gordon and Morgan Neville, tells the story of the eruption that occurred when these two provocative men were put on television to argue during the 1968 political conventions. Our critic at large, John Powers, says it gets you thinking about changes in American politics, culture, and political debate.
After the Republicans held their lively first debate, you heard people saying what they always say nowadays, that our media-driven political discourse has become shallow and petty, even clownish. Hearing this, an innocent young person might believe that not so long ago, America was a latter-day Athens, in which political arguments were magnificent in their purity and eloquence. For a useful antidote to this idea, I recommend Best of Enemies, a new documentary by Robert Gordon and Morgan Neville. It chronicles what happened when ABC News, running a poor third in the ratings, decided to amp up coverage of the 1968 political conventions by staging a series of debates between two of America's most famous, entertaining, and self-satisfied intellectuals. On the right was William F. Buckley, the devoutly Catholic editor and TV host who's been called the St. Paul of modern conservatism. His opponent was the novelist, essayist, and playwright Gore Vidal, the Cicero of the patrician left, who owned a villa in Italy. These two mandarins didn't merely have conflicting politics and morality. They loathed one another viscerally. For each, it felt like confronting his evil twin. For what they shared, beyond an obvious sense of entitlement, was a dazzling gift for polemic. Speaking with aristocratic drawls we no longer hear on the air, both wielded language like natural-born killers, Buckley's sinuous rhetoric squeezing you tight like a python, Vidal striking quick and hard, like a rattlesnake. From the start, they didn't so much debate issues as try to take the other guy down. Vidal attacked with rehearsed ad-libs, while the lizard-tongued Buckley spoke of Vidal's novel, Myra Breckinridge, as if it were a tissue infected with TB. Their snippiness finally exploded in the ninth debate, when Chicago police attacked anti-war demonstrators. Vidal baited Buckley by calling him a crypto-Nazi, and Buckley replied by calling him a queer. It all begins with a question from moderator Howard K. Smith.
Mr. Vidal, wasn't it a provocative act to try to raise the Viet Cong flag in the park in the film we just saw? Wouldn't that invite raising a Nazi flag in World War II would have had similar consequences?
You're so naive. People in the United States happen to believe that the United States policy is wrong in Vietnam, and the Viet Cong are correct in wanting to organize their country in their own way politically. If it is a novelty in Chicago, that is too bad. But I assume that the point of the American democracy
and some
is you can express
too.
Any
some
point of view you want.
Nazi.
Shut up a minute.
No, I won't. And some people were pro-Nazi, and the answer is that they were well-treated by people who ostracized them, and I'm for ostracizing people who egg on other people to shoot American Marines and American soldiers.
As far as I'm concerned, the only sort of pro-crypto-Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that,
Such
a messy exchange would be memorable even today. With it, Vidal won the real debate. Not over issues, but over which man could preserve the exquisite poise that was his trademark. By getting Buckley to curse, name-call, and threaten violence, the smirking Vidal had goaded his counterculture-hitting foe into letting it all hang out. That moment is the only reason anyone remembers these debates. But not content to see this flare-up as an amusing historical footnote, Gordon and Neville try to pump the debates up into grander significance, suggesting they set the template for the bickering free-for-all that is the norm in today's political coverage. Now, it's certainly true that the Vidal-Buckley crossfire did anticipate the future of political discussion on television, not least by getting two brilliant men to behave cartoonishly. Yet what we see now is the reductio ad absurdum of that. After all, Vidal and Buckley were learned, lavishly articulate men with carefully developed worldviews. That's not something you'd say of the folks blasting their opinions on ABC, Fox, or MSNBC. Buckley famously wrote, "A conservative is a fellow who is standing athwart history, yelling stop." But it doesn't stop, which casts these debates in a different light. 47 years on, it's clear that Buckley's conservatism won the political battle. His free market anti-government ideas now dominate. Culturally, though, Vidal's values won, not least his libertarian, label-free ideas of sexuality. One imagines Buckley blanching at the right to gay marriage, or at the triumph of hip-hop. So who leaves the greater legacy? At the moment, the nod goes to Buckley, who led a movement that demonstrably changed how America thinks and organizes itself, even if it's hard to imagine any of his writings lasting as more than mere documents. In contrast, Vidal's influence on American life was minor, yet he was a vastly more talented writer, whose novels about our past, like Burr and Lincoln, may give him an enduring fame that will outlast Buckley's. In the grand historical sweep, the Vidal-Buckley encounter's true meaning isn't really political. Rather, it marked the end of the days when literary figures and public intellectuals still had prestige. Days when writers like Vidal, Buckley, Norman Mailer, Truman Capote, and James Baldwin, all men you'll notice, could actually be regular guests on The Tonight Show. Can you imagine Jimmy Fallon or Megyn Kelly even booking Don DeLillo or Hilary Mantel, let alone caring what they think? I sure can't, although I have high hopes for Stephen Colbert.
John Powers writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. Our next guest, Lily Tomlin, has a new movie called Grandma, and also co-stars with Jane Fonda in the Netflix series Grace and Frankie. So now, at the age of 75, an age when so many actresses feel shut out of roles, Tomlin's career is going great. She also got married in her 70s, a year and a half ago, to her longtime partner Jane Wagner, who wrote a lot of Tomlin's comedy material, including her popular one-woman shows. Tomlin first became nationally known in 1969 when she joined the cast of the NBC sketch comedy series Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. She's been in many movies, including Nashville, 9 to 5, All of Me, Flirting with Disaster, and I Heart Huckabees. Terry spoke with Tomlin earlier this month and began with a scene from the new film Grandma. Tomlin plays Elle, a lesbian whose partner of 38 years died a year and a half ago. Her new, much younger girlfriend breaks up with her in the first scene. And then Elle's granddaughter shows up to ask for a favor. She needs money for an abortion. Elle doesn't object to the abortion, but she's temporarily broke. So they go on a little road trip, looking for people from Elle's past who might help. At a coffee shop, Elle is complaining loudly about the difficulty of getting an abortion.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
Excuse me?
I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
When? When are you going to have to ask us?
I'm going to have to ask you to leave now.
Oh, you are asking us.
Yes, you're disturbing the customers.
I'm a customer. I mean, do you know what a customer is?
I know what a customer is.
Well, a customer is someone who pays for your services, so I am a customer. I mean, what other customers are we disturbing? Oh, them, Ozzie and Harriet?
Yes, you are disturbing them.
No, we're disturbing you. Isn't that right?
Yes, you are also disturbing me.
Lily Tomlin, welcome to Fresh Air. So this is the first time you're playing a lesbian after it's kind of official that you're out now. Like, you, a lot of people knew before,
well,
but now that
I've been out for 10 or 11 or 12 years or something. I mean, finally somebody printed it.
What,
I mean,
what do you mean?
Did interviews for years, even when I was on the cover of Time. I mean, Jane was always there. We were touring, working on the Appearing Nightly, our first Broadway show. My publicist had almost pulled off the two magazines, Newsweek and Time, and at the last minute, Newsweek got wind of it, and they put someone else on the cover. But they'd done a big story on me, which was Inside, and one magazine says I lived in the Hollywood Hills with, I shared a house with writer Jane Wagner, and the other one said I lived alone.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So that was back in the 70s.
Well, you had said that Time magazine back in 1975 said they'd give you the cover if you came out.
Right. And I chose not to. And then I got the cover in 77 with my first Broadway show.
Can you talk about that decision of saying to them, no, thank you?
Well, I was sort of tempted. And in some ways, I wanted to make a big declaration like that, but I didn't. They wanted a gay person, and I wanted to be acknowledged for my performance. And so I was a little bit insulted and a little bit stimulated by the idea, but I ultimately just came down on the side of my own sense of things.
The fact that you were gay was like kind of an open secret for a long time. I interviewed you in 1989 on Fresh Air, and I had heard that you were gay, but that you weren't, you know, officially out. And I thought, although you were out to a lot of people, I thought definitely it is not something I can ask you about back in 1989. I'm wondering, this is a weird question, but I'm wondering if in 1989, in our interview, I had asked you about being a lesbian, how would you have handled that?
I probably would have said something like, yes, I am. I couldn't have lied. It would have been too diminishing to lie. You know, I would have said, well, this may come as a surprise to some, but I am.
So what is it like for you as a performer to be in your mid-70s? And
yeah, I'm 75.
So your 70s have been a really big decade for you. You're getting, you know, major roles. Right now you've got the Netflix series and a new movie. You're a regular on Lisa Kudrow's Web Therapy.
Right, yes.
You got married in your 70s. So I don't know. That must feel really good that things, instead of...
Well,
I
don't
know. Diminishing professionally, they're expanding?
Well, no, it is good. It's terrific. I think if it hadn't happened, I wouldn't know terribly the difference. I would just go on doing what I did or lying in a hammock or something, I think I would have been satisfied. I mean, I always work on the stage anyway. I go out and do dates.
Right.
And I've done that since I was well known, since I was on Laugh-In.
Right.
As soon as I could sell a house, that's what I did, because I'd had an act all my life since I was like 8 years old or something. I mean, an act I did on the back porch. But nonetheless, I sold tickets back then, too.
Very enterprising.
Yeah.
So your formative years in show business were just before Stonewall, starting to perform on stage, starting to make the rounds of some of the talk shows. But your really big break, Laugh-In, basically coincided with Stonewall. They were both the same year, 1969.
Right. I went on Laugh-In the last day of 69, the last Monday of 69. It was December 29th.
So what was it like for you to have your career as a network television star coincide with, like, this landmark in the gay rights movement?
Well, I think naturally I was, wanting to be in show business and not wanting to be strictly identified as a gay performer, I wanted to be identified as a performer. And I did a range of kind of culture types, which I was most interested in. I mean, if people would say I'd like to do, I was slow coming around to doing a gay character. I kind of wanted to do one on Laugh-In, but then, do a physically gay, you know, some kind of butch girl or something that would be interesting and kind of new to be seen in that kind of venue. I was looking more to draw attention to myself as an artist by my inventiveness.
What would that character have been like had you actually?
I'm not sure.
Her?
I think she just would have been kind of boyish. Her hair would be short in some fashion. I don't know what she would have been. I never really put her on her feet.
And why?
But I thought it would be an interesting type to do.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I also had my eye to whether I did really overtly or not. But I was more interested in speaking to humanity as a whole. So I would have liked to have included a character like that. I was also more interested in doing men. I thought it would be more eye-catching for me to do male characters and also to show empathy for certain male characters, the least likely ones. Like I did the first male I did was in Appearing Nightly, and I did Rick the Singles Bar Cruiser. And he was macho and typically macho. It was, you know, kind of easy to do. And I said, well, I don't think I should do any more men until I can do as many men as I do women. I was operating in a somewhat limited sphere. Although you don't identify a gay character strictly by her physicality or his physicality.
You've always done characters. What do you think it is about you that has all these characters living inside of you? You know, like a lot of actors, they just want to, like, do roles that they're given. They don't have characters living inside them who they do for years and years because those characters stay alive with inside them.
Yeah, or they're just kind of playing themselves. Those are the real movie stars.
Mm-hmm.
I think I separated. It was just one kind of performance that I could get up and do. And nobody else on the boards was really doing that characters to that extent. First of all, there's very few women that were in the beginning. When I was coming up, there were just a handful of women who were well known. Like, I mean, Joan had already made it, so she was. Joan Rivers, and she would perform in the downstairs room, and I was in the review upstairs, and I used to slip down between numbers, and I would listen to her in the downstairs room. I'd crack the door, and just so enjoyed her outrageousness. One woman that I saw as a young person, Jean Carroll, I'd corresponded with her a little bit after I got well known, because I'd been very impacted by her. My mother. We'd see her on Ed Sullivan in the early 50s, and she always was very breezy, kind of feminine style, and would wear a cocktail dress and a cocktail hat or sometimes a mink stole. And she did husband jokes, and my mother would just laugh. She would be so delighted. My mother had a wonderful sense of humor, and I would enjoy it because of that. But I thought, what is that woman doing? She's doing something. I mean, I didn't use the word subversive, but I felt that there was a little turn to what she did.
I read that your father was an alcoholic. How did that affect your growing up? And the,
well, you know
the atmosphere at home when you were growing up.
Well, my father worked very, I mean, he was a very good worker, and he worked 5 days a week. He never missed work. So he wasn't like an alcoholic who is not functioning. And my dad would go out on the weekends. He'd go to the track. He'd go to the bookie joint. And by the time I was, you know, able to walk capably, he took me to the bars with him, and he took me to the track with him on the weekends. And I would place his bets when I got to be, you know, 14 or so, because kids just looked, girls looked older then. I have a beehive hairdo and a sheath dress, and I'd go to the window and buy my father's tickets, and sometimes I would hold his money. I wouldn't bet it. And my heart would just leap out of my chest, because I worried about my dad always betting on everything, and he was a factory worker. He didn't have the money to bet, and he always had a front roll in his pocket. I would book his bets so that he would not lose the money.
Right.
And, of course, I was taking a chance every time, because if he had won, I wouldn't have been able to bring him the cash.
Do you think that going with your father to the races and placing bets and things like that helped you learn how to be assertive and speak assertively?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, that's part of it. And then somehow, I mean, I can remember my mother was forever being preyed upon by, you know, door-to-door salesmen. They used to, I mean, this is my own interpretation of it, but I always thought they sort of preyed on working class women who, and they were often up from the South or someplace like that. And when she first came to the North, she was more easily intimidated, although not intimidated, but just authority figures would be a bit daunting for her because she grew up on a farm and stuff like that. And I remember she had just a particular inclination to buy vacuum cleaners. And my mother would be mad at herself for caving into these guys and buying another vacuum cleaner. And I remember when I was 14, I was looking through the closet and I found an old vacuum cleaner stuffed up in the back. It was a Kenmore. And they were fairly expensive in those days. And I called the guy. I said, "Mother, sure, give me the contract. Let me read it." She brings me the contract. I look at it, and I see that it says, "You can change your mind in 72 hours or something like that. And so I called the guy up, and I said, "You come and get this vacuum cleaner. My mother doesn't want it." And he gave me a hard time. And when he came up to the house, I pitched the vacuum cleaner out at the bottom of the stairs. We'd moved into a house by this time. We'd lived in an apartment all that time till I was about 14. And I think a sense of injustice stayed with me for most of my life.
Recently, you played women who were hippies in the 60s. Well, you play that now on Grace and Frankie. And in the movie Flirting with Disaster, you're the birth mother of the Ben Stiller character, and you and your husband,
yes,
Alan Alda, were hippies in the 60s. Did you feel well-suited to that role?
No, not any more than I would be well-suited to, like, an Ozzie and Harriet character. I feel like, I mean, that they're sort of fun to play if you can get a good beat on them, but they've been done to death.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't so much I wasn't like strictly a hippie in the 60s. I played so many roles. I even in high school, I mean, I went to an accelerated high school that had an art, music, art, music, engineering. They had specialized curricula. And every department had a hangout. And I was like one of the few people that just went to all the hangouts. I would like kind of circulate around. I'd go to And if I'd get in with the groove for a while, I'd hang out at that place. And sometimes I dressed to go with the hangout. It was like a costume. I liked doing all that. I liked being a part of so many different things. I would dress real hoodie. I'd go through a big hoodie phase where I wore, you know, peg skirts with a scatter pin at the top of the pleat at the bottom, and black stockings with seams and ballet shoes and a sweater turned around backwards with a tanker jacket. Oh, and smoke Pall Malls, and then I would go real arty. I'd have like a real dirty tennis trench coat and knee socks and sneakers that were all beat up. I just liked to play all those roles. I didn't think of it as playing roles, as I just did, sort of having fun, dressing up for school or something.
When you were 8 and starting to do characters on your back porch, who were those characters? Where did those characters come from? Were you doing impressions of people in your neighborhood or your family?
Yeah,
or were they
I
just
do.
Coming from within?
No, I do people from my family as best I can recall, and I would do people that were in the building, and I also would have ideas about something. And I would imitate people I saw on television, like Jean Carroll. I would put on my mother's slip, like an evening dress, and tell husband jokes.
At the age of 8?
Yeah, I'd say.
That's hilarious.
I'll never forget, and I'd take her style. I'll never forget the first time I saw my husband standing on a hill, his hair blowing in the breeze, and he too proud to run after it.
At 8, you're telling this? Is that one of,
yes,
is that one of her
those,
jokes, or is that an original?
That's one of her jokes. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's one of her jokes.
Well, Lily Tomlin, thank you for coming back on our show.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Lily Tomlin stars in the new movie Grandma and stars with Jane Fonda in the Netflix series Grace and Frankie. She spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.